This is the final chapter in this second unit, which should make sense because the test is scheduled for a week from today, right? Must be. So write yourself a note to, if you're getting Scantrons one at a time, buy some more, or if you don't carry them with you, make sure you have them for the next test. Anyway, this final chapter is all about the plasma membrane. And we've already talked about the membrane actually in pretty much detail, including what is shown here in slide one, but it's good to go over this again. The plasma membrane of any cell is made mostly, in terms of number of molecules involved, of phospholipids. And what did I say is remarkable about phospholipids? What is the word that describes their chemical behavior?
That they're both hydrophilic and hydrophobic.
Right. What is the one word that means that? That's right, too. But that describes the individual ends of the molecule. There's a word that I gave you, which is amphipathic. That's the word that I said means having dual feelings or dual preferences. Phospholipids are amphipathic, which means one part of the molecule, and each molecule individually, is hydrophobic, and another part of that same molecule is hydrophilic. So as you correctly said, hydrophilic means water-loving. Which part of a phospholipid is hydrophilic? It'll be facing the outside, but if you just have one phospholipid and no water molecules, you're just looking at an isolated phospholipid, which part of the phospholipid do we say is hydrophilic? The head. And what makes it hydrophilic? Well, actually, even more basic question. What makes any hydrophilic thing hydrophilic? Why is it that a molecule wants to be around water, in a sense?
Polar.
Right. Hydrophilic, you should equate in your mind with polar. What is it in the head of a phospholipid that makes it polar? We actually don't see that detail here, but we've looked at that before when we studied the various macromolecules.
Phosphate?
Exactly. So let's... I don't have that chapter up, but we already looked at this slide. Let's mentally recreate it, though. Hopefully you can remember it. A single phospholipid is similar to a fat or triglyceride or triacylglycerol, because both of those molecules, a fat or a phospholipid, both of those have what three carbon compound as part of the structure? That three carbon compound has three connection points that can be made with other pieces that you can add. What is it that holds a fat together, in other words? Yeah, well, yes, that's the bond. But what are the tails of a fat connected to?
A glycerol.
Which is a three-carbon alcohol, right? It's really a triple alcohol because there's three OHs. So a glycerol is a molecule in its own right, but if it's going to be part of a bigger molecule, that means there are three places on that glycerol that you can connect things to it. Well, in a fat, all three of those things are fatty acid tails. So there's three fatty acids hooked to the same glycerol, and that makes a fat or triglyceride or triacylglycerol. I just said that a phospholipid is very similar to that because it also has a glycerol, So you can connect three things to it. But in a phospholipid, only two of those things are fatty acids, the tails. That's why each one in cartoon form has only two tails, not three. That leaves one more thing you can connect to that same glycerol. And the detail isn't shown here, but that's in the head. And that third thing, as you indicated, is a phosphate group. And a phosphate, remember, is a phosphorus atom with four oxygen atoms, but the oxygen atom, one of those oxygen atoms is ionized. And so that's a full charge. That's beyond polar. A polar molecule has a partial charge, like water. An ion has a full charge, and it is even more hydrophilic in a sense. So that's why, overall, the phospholipid is amphipathic. The polar head, which is where the charge is, because of the phosphate group, wants to be around other things that have partial charges, including water molecules. So they're therefore hydrophilic. But how would you describe most of the structure of a fatty acid? Whether it's one of the three that are in a fat, or whether it's one of the two in a phospholipid. A fatty acid is by itself, before it gets stuck onto the glycerol, a molecule. But how would you describe it chemically? What makes up a fatty acid?
It's mostly like carbon and hydrogen, right?
Right. And therefore it's almost, but not quite, a hydrocarbon. If it weren't for the one end, and what is at the end of that hydrocarbon chain? What kind of functional group?
It's a carboxyl.
Right. That's what a fatty acid is. A carboxyl group with a chain of carbons and hydrogens, so many carbons long. Well, the carbons and hydrogens, as we've talked about several times already, have more or less equal electronegativities, which is why hydrocarbons are nonpolar. Because that equality of electronegativities means that they share their electrons equally. They aren't polar. And therefore the tails, whether they're in a fat, the fatty acids, which is what I'm calling the tails, whether they're in a fat or whether they're in a phospholipid, the fatty acid tails do not want to be around water. For a fat, the whole molecule doesn't want to be around water. Because the whole thing is not amphipathic, it's just hydrophobic. Which is why oil and water don't mix. Oil is fat. But in a phospholipid, only part of the phospholipid doesn't want to be around water. That's the two hydrophobic tails. And when you get a bunch of them together, they will automatically, because of that amphipathic nature, self-assemble into a phospholipid bilayer without anything being alive. This is just a bunch of phospholipids in a bunch of water molecules put together. They will automatically make a little cell-like bag made out of two layers of phospholipid called the phospholipid bilayer. That's how the first cell started. But they do that because having this tail-to-tail arrangement of the two monolayers that make up the bilayer means that those tails, which are hydrophobic, don't have to be exposed to water. That's why they're doing it. And the heads, being hydrophilic, have no problem being around the water, whether it's the inside water or the outside water. And so that's why the heads are pointing outward from the thickness. They're on the surfaces, inner surface and outer surface. Well, you have this form automatically just because of the amphipathic nature. But what we see here is just purely phospholipid bilayer. And so this is not a plasma membrane. This is how plasma membranes got their start. That's how the first cells formed eventually. But if all you have are phospholipids, that can't keep a cell alive, because a major function of the plasma membrane is to allow certain things through it to get either into or out of the cell, and to exclude other things from getting into or out. What is the phrase that refers to such a membrane? What kind of membrane is it if only certain things can go through it?
Semipermeable.
Right, semipermeable, or even better, selectively permeable. Because semipermeable technically means half permeable, and which is not quite right. But also selectively permeable means it's up to the cell what gets in and out, at least to an extent. And so you can't have in a living cell only a phospholipid bilayer, because some of the things that have to get into or out of cells for it to remain alive will not be able to get through the phospholipid bilayer directly. A complete plasma membrane is therefore chiefly phospholipids, but with other things mixed in as well, as we can see in slide 2. There's all kinds of things that are mixed in with the phospholipids, but one very important type of thing other than the phospholipids is what's shown in this cartoon form. All these blue globs are proteins. And so a complete plasma membrane is phospholipids with proteins plus other kinds of molecules as well. But these proteins are examples of membrane-bound proteins, right? Not membrane-bounded. The proteins are not enclosed by their own membrane. The proteins are part of that membrane. They're tied to the membrane. So these are membrane-bound proteins. And one important thing about a phospholipid bilayer that I haven't mentioned at all yet, I told you that it automatically forms if you have multiple phospholipids. They automatically take on that arrangement. But importantly, they remain individual phospholipid molecules. They're not chemically bonded to each other in that bilayer. Right? So these two neighbors are not hooked together. They're just occupying spaces next to each other. And they are actually, as we'll talk more about in a minute, free to move around. All right. Similarly, these membrane-bound proteins, even though they're called membrane-bound, which means tied to the membrane, they are not covalently tied. They don't have chemical bonds holding them in place. That means that they are able to move around in this membrane as well, side to side. Now you might say, what is it that holds them to the membrane then? Holds them in place? And specifically, what holds them in place rather than going fully into the cell or fully out of the cell is the fact that a protein is made of R groups, right? A protein is made of amino acids, each of which has an R group, and there are different categories of R groups. So you don't see the detail here, but always remember that a protein is made up of at least one polypeptide, and each polypeptide is a ribbon of many amino acids. So there's a ribbon here, even though you don't see it. A long string of amino acids that have folded into some shape. Well, if you look at the primary structure of the polypeptide, what is the primary structure? What does primary structure refer to? Right. So if you stretch it out and not let it fold up into some shape, just look at it as a necklace, there is some specific sequence of amino acids, right? That's the primary sequence, the primary structure. Each individual amino acid can be any of the 20, but it has an R group of some sort, right? Well, we talked about what makes them fold up into three-dimensional shape is R groups getting close to each other that want to be close to each other, right? But think about the major categories of amino acids. We looked at the polar ones and the nonpolar ones. This is an overall necklace. But on this end, which is exposed to the exterior water, and this end, I shouldn't say end because you don't know where the ends of the ribbon are, but this part, which is exposed to the exterior water, and this part, which is exposed to the interior water, the amino acids in those parts of this ribbon happen to have R groups that are polar. So they like being around the water they're exposed to. All of the amino acids in the thickness of this layer of membrane have R groups that are nonpolar. So they don't want to be exposed to the water, and they have no problem being around the other nonpolar things next to them, the tails of the phospholipids. So if you imagine trying to push this thing into the cell, or push it out of the cell, move it up or down in the picture, in other words, you're going to be exposing this polar part of the protein to a nonpolar part of the membrane, which it doesn't want to be next to. Doesn't matter which direction you go, you're going to expose one polar region to this nonpolar interior of the thickness. You see what I'm saying there? And that's what holds it in place. It's more or less buoyed there, just like a buoy in the ocean, floating in this bilayer of phospholipids that are also not connected to each other, but are held in that arrangement because the hydrophobic things are trying to avoid being next to water. Okay, now to three. Well, there are all kinds of proteins that are embedded into the membrane of any given cell. But what we see is that there isn't an equal distribution of the proteins. You have an overall bilayer, but if you use a careful technique called freeze fracturing, you can separate the two monolayers, as you see in this cartoon version, from each other. And when you do that, you find that some of the proteins are going to be associated with one monolayer, some are going to be associated with the other monolayer. But it's not an equal half and half arrangement. Most of the proteins are more associated with the inner monolayer than with the outer monolayer, is what this shows. And that shouldn't surprise you, really, and you can see that many more dots here. That's the inner layer. Shouldn't really surprise you because a lot of the proteins that are part of the membrane are doing jobs affecting the interior of the cell where the metabolism is occurring. All right. Now to four. Well, I've already told you that these phospholipids are not bonded to each other. They're just held in place by avoidance of water, avoidance of the tails with water. And that arrangement, since they're not connected to each other with covalent bonds, means that they're able to change places with each other. It's a bilayer, but let's just think of one monolayer as a crowd of humans. You know, like if you look from a skyscraper down onto Times Square at New Year's Eve, you see a sea of drunk humans, right? Forming more or less a monolayer. Each one has a head. But they're right next to each other. They're not going to stay there, though, right? They're free to move around. So at different parts in the night, they'll be in different positions, but it's still in that same layer. Similarly with phospholipids. And we call this the fluid mosaic model of membrane structure. Well, what is a mosaic in everyday terms, not in biology? Right, it's a form of art that instead of using a pencil or paint to make the image, you glue pieces of something, little tiles or whatever, to some surface to make the overall picture. So they're like little pixels within an overall picture. That's a mosaic. This is called this arrangement of phospholipids is called a fluid mosaic because instead of being glued in place and not changing, they're free to go anywhere they want within that layer since they're not bonded to each other. And it might surprise you just how much they are moving around within a monolayer. Lateral movement, as you see on the top here, refers to two phospholipids within the same monolayer switching places with each other. Lateral means to the side. So they're moving side to side within one layer. And that happens about 10 million times per second. So is the phospholipid, the plasma membrane is just like the cell in general, always changing. It's a highly dynamic structure. It's also possible to undergo what's called flip-flop here, but that's much more rare, and it should make sense that it's rare. A flip-flop means that phospholipids in two different monolayers are switching places with each other. But if you imagine trying to force that to happen, to do that, you would have to temporarily expose these polar heads to the interior hydrophobic thickness. And they wouldn't want to be that way, right? But once you got them over halfway, then they would kind of snap the rest of the way easily. So that doesn't happen very often, but it can happen. All right, that's the fluid mosaic model. On the part B of this, in the middle, we have the importance of membrane fluidity. So it's a fluid mosaic, but fluid simply means that it's able to move. There are degrees of fluidity. And at any given moment, there's a correct amount of fluidity that a cell should have in order for it to do its job and stay alive. But the fluidity is affected by external environmental factors, like temperature, for instance. Okay, the membrane itself is made out of phospholipids. Not only are the phospholipids continuously moving around, but also they're not there permanently. The cell can put new phospholipids in and take other phospholipids out of the membrane. Okay? Now think back to when we talked about fats, which these are not, but they're kind of similar because they feature fatty acid tails. There are different kinds of fatty acids, right? Which is why there are different kinds of fats. And remember, we talked about two different ways in which fatty acids can differ from each other. One is that they can be longer or shorter. But the other really important way is that they can be either unsaturated fatty acids or saturated fatty acids. What is true of a saturated fatty acid?
Saturated fatty acids don't have the kink, right?
Right, and they don't have the kink because of what? What actually makes them saturated? Right. There are only single bonds between the carbons, however many there are in that chain. And since there are only single bonds, there aren't any kinks, like you said. An unsaturated fatty acid has at least one, maybe more, double bond. And each double bond forms a little kink or a bend in the fatty acid. Well, I talked about comparing them to wires, and how they, if you threw them into a box, they would stack a lot more closely together if they weren't bent, if they were saturated, in other words. And if you make your plasma membrane at the moment out of mostly saturated phospholipids, meaning phospholipids with saturated fatty acids, then they will pack together more tightly. That will make it less fluid, less loose. But if you make your plasma membrane out of phospholipids featuring unsaturated fatty acids that are bent, then it will be looser. And the cell is doing this by taking some phospholipids out and putting new ones in based on what the adjustment in fluidity should be. For instance, if the temperature drops, that's going to make things more solid. And too solid. It's not going to be loose enough in that case. So the cell will respond by increasing the amount of phospholipids featuring unsaturated fatty acids to loosen it up. But the other extreme, when the temperature gets warmer, it would get too loose then. And so it would feature, it would respond by making the plasma membrane feature more phospholipids that have saturated fatty acids to tighten it up. That occurs in any given kind of cell, because remember, all cells feature plasma membranes, all cells feature phospholipids as their plasma membranes, even though there are different kinds of phospholipids. On the bottom, we have something occurring in animal cells, which you should have guessed by reading cholesterol here. Cholesterol is an animal product. I told you that plants make phytosterols, and there's other kinds of sterols, that, like ergosterols that fungi make. But animals make cholesterol. And I've already told you several important reasons why animals can't live without cholesterol, like being the precursor to all the steroid hormones, for instance, and also precursor to vitamin D. Well, here we have yet another important reason that animal cells have cholesterol, because cholesterol molecules are important components of animal plasma membranes. They also affect the fluidity. And they not only affect the fluidity, as you can see, they kind of fill gaps here and there to affect the fluidity. Also, they affect the permeability. So by adjusting how much cholesterol an animal cell has, the animal can adjust the permeability and the fluidity. Okay. Slide five shows you a cartoon version of the results of an experiment to test the fluid mosaic hypothesis. And here we have two different kinds of cells, as you can see, one from a mouse, one from a human. Both animal cells, but different animals. And each one features proteins in its membranes, in its plasma membrane. Well, here you can see them as magenta and blue. But in the real experiment, they used chemical technique to mark the proteins in each of the two cells, but they marked them differently so that they could keep track of which ones were which. All right, they were detectable because of the markings that they used. It wasn't really that they made them pink. But anyway, they used a special technique to then fuse the two cells into one hybrid cell that's half mouse cell and half human cell. And this actually is fairly easy to do because, as I've told you before, membrane material is membrane material, and it kind of melts into itself when two pieces encounter each other. Well, at the very moment that this hybrid cell is created, of course, you're going to have all the mouse proteins on one end and all the human proteins at the other end. If the fluid mosaic hypothesis is not true, then you'd expect it to stay that way, right? Because the fluid mosaic model being not true means that they're not moving around within their layers. That's not what they found, though. Didn't take long before they saw that diffusion of these two proteins had taken place. They're all spread out, both kinds. And you see mouse and human on all places in the cell. So it's pretty good evidence that the fluid mosaic model is true. Now to six. In six, we have various kinds of proteins that we're looking at, because just like in the very similar picture in the previous chapter, we have proteins in orange making up the cytoskeleton, proteins in blue making up extracellular matrix. Those are important for other reasons I've already talked about, but that's actually not the proteins we want to focus on in this slide. In this slide, we want to focus on all of the blue proteins that are part of the membrane. These are all the membrane-bound proteins. Well, a membrane-bound protein simply means that it is connected to the membrane in some way. So that's a big category. But there's different ways that you can have membrane-bound proteins. So there are different categories of membrane-bound proteins. One category of which is called peripheral proteins. The periphery of something is simply the edge. So a peripheral protein is a protein that doesn't stick through the thickness of the phospholipid bilayer. Instead, a peripheral protein is associated with just one surface, either the interior surface or the exterior surface, just as you see in this cartoon. Okay, so that's one subcategory of membrane-bound proteins. The other major subcategory is a category called integral proteins. And unfortunately, this picture doesn't do a very good job of showing that there are really two subcategories of that. But integral means part of the integrity, part of what holds something together. And an integral protein is one that does extend at least partially through the thickness of the membrane, unlike a peripheral protein. In other words, integral proteins are exposed to at least some of the tails in that middle part of the thickness. But what the book should have done is shown you that there are two different ways that can happen. So integral proteins, which is one category of membrane-bound proteins, can then be subdivided again. Because some integral proteins stick only part of the way through, and that's what they didn't show you an example of, but you can imagine it. A protein that goes halfway through the thickness, for instance, would still be integral. But then there are some integral proteins that stick all the way through the thickness, as the one labeled integral protein does here. And that is a special case of an integral protein called a transmembrane protein. Transmembrane just means across the membrane, through it, all the way. So a transmembrane protein is not only an integral protein, but it's a protein that is exposed to both the extracellular fluid and the intracellular fluid at the same time, different parts of the same protein. Right, this part is exposed to the exterior, this part is exposed to the interior. We also, though, see that there are various carbohydrates involved here in green that are also important components of membranes. Glyco is the word root that means sugar. And so there are such things as glycolipids, which are lipids, phospholipids or lipids, that are connected then to some carbohydrate of some size, and that overall thing is therefore partly carbohydrate, partly lipid. It's a glycolipid. And there are also such things as glycoproteins, which is the same thing except that the sugar is connected to a protein that's part of the membrane. And one big use of these, as we'll talk more about in a different slide, is that the sugar part of the glycolipids or glycoproteins act more or less like a little ID badge, identifying that kind of cell as being that kind of cell, which is really important in a multicellular organism. Right? You are trillions of cells, but then there are even more than that in the space you call your body that aren't your own cells. And it's important for your body to know which of the cells are your own and which are other cells, which are potential invaders. So you have these little sugars acting as little ID badges. Now that is where I'm going to stop today, so remind me that I'm on 7.